Welcome to Nashville and Beyond.
I'm Brian Copeland.
And I'm Zach Copeland.
And we're a father-son duo helping people buy, sell, and thrive in Middle Tennessee.
But this isn't just about business. It's also about our family and our community.
It's a front row seat to how we live, work, and serve right here in Music City.
So buckle up as we explore Nashville and Beyond.
I'll go first.
Perfect.
When it comes to music, I was working in East Tennessee. One of my very best friends was a marvelous musician, and he was like, why don't you come to Nashville and work for me at this record label that's just kind of starting out? We want to have a publishing company. And I said, what's publishing? I had no clue what publishing was. And he's like, you don't need to worry about what you don't know about that. He goes, you know music.
Yeah.
You're a great businessman. You have a college degree. I was 21, 22 at this point. He goes, and let's just go venture together. Well, little did I know that he was going to turn into someone in gospel music that you see him every single year nominated for a Dove Award.
Yeah.
He's produced orchestrations for some major A-list pop artists, all kinds of stuff, and owns a Broadway jazz label now out of New York City and another gospel label. And, I didn't know, part of this is journeying in life. And I didn't realize that journey was going to take me into all the relationships I built in the music industry. So I was the director of publishing for that label. And my job was, to help songwriters write songs. And artists would come to me and say, hey, we need a song in a 3-4 time signature that's upbeat, but it's about this theme. And so I'd, of course, search through the catalog and see if it was there. And if not, we would set up co-writing. And so I had, I had people who had been on the Grand Ole Opry that I worked with who were kind of in their songwriting years. Some people I had grown up listening, Lord, my East Tennessee's coming out. Some people I had grown up listening to in their songs. And, sitting down with some of those songwriters that I listened to as a kid and going, oh my gosh, you'll be working with me now was, a big honor. So, it was a fun job. There's a lot of, memory things. I remember, and I think this has a lot to do with some of the people that we work with who come to Nashville. I remember sitting at my desk one day, and the phone rang and this guy was on the other line. And he said, hey, I've moved here. And I was like, well, who is this?
Yeah.
He goes, I'm so-and-so and I've moved to Nashville to be a songwriter. And I was like, have you talked to, I started naming some of my colleagues' names. And he's like, nope, I'm just here. And I've moved here and I'm living in a hotel on Trinity Lane.
1 in 10 people in Nashville, by the way.
Yeah. And it was like, oh my gosh. We call that unsolicited material.
Yeah.
We don't take unsolicited material because if you do, you're going to have
stacks
of music. And, to hear the disappointment in his voice.
Yeah.
And you're saying, oh, Brian, you're heartless. These were the kind of things that we had to deal with every day.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people come to Nashville with their musical dreams, and I love these people. We get to hear their stories, and because many of them are waiting at our tables and all that kind of stuff. But, that was an interesting story to go through.
Well, talk to me about the digitization of catalogs.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I would love to hear that story.
So a lot of people, I started in the music industry before, we literally had cassette tapes.
Yeah.
Compact discs or CDs were first starting to be burned. But there was no digital files really out there. Everything was analog. And we were a new publishing company. And so Napster started coming forward.
Mm-hmm.
And people were saying, well, this is interesting. It's illegal, all this stuff. But it's like, what part of this can we use?
Yeah.
And so I said, we got such a small catalog. I can probably digitize this if I can figure out how to do it. So I remember calling Dell. It was Gateway Computers back then.
Okay.
Which I think became Dell.
Gateway.
And calling Radio Shack for the cords I needed.
Radio Shack. RIP.
Uh-huh. And I got one of our little mini disc. I don't know what it was back then. And I had to play it in live time.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just start digitally uploading them. And I did one of the very first online song pitches on AOL.com. And it went from our studio in North Nashville down to a studio down in South Nashville. And it took all night to upload, but because we got the song there early and it was the first one there this morning, as opposed to everyone who had overnighted things, and it was so unique to get, the song got cut. It was one of our first cuts. And so we had the first digital, fully digital catalog in the city, and it was small again, but, and people started asking me from these big labels, you know, because we were an indie label. They started asking, well, how did you do this? And, you know, to go speak at places with like Naris, which does the Grammys, one called CCLI, which is out of, they had a conference over in London, England. I got to speak to about digital rights management. And again, I was 24, 25 at this point. And, you know, that really taught me I was ahead of the curve on that. And I learned that sometimes it's not about having the very best stuff, but it's about innovating in a way that no one else is innovating that draws attention. So that's my big,
That's cool. Yeah, I just want to mention too that you named four companies or businesses that don't exist anymore. You did Napster, Radio Shack, Gateway, and AOL, and four of those are gone now. So I think it's pretty cool that that happened.
Well, AOL still exists. You just can't get the, they just discontinue some online pieces. But three don't exist anymore.
So what are some of the takeaways that you took from your time in the music industry that maybe you think are applicable in the real estate world?
Well, what's so funny, and I don't, we may do another podcast episode about this, so if I say the story twice in the future, it is what it is. I got into video first. So when YouTube was coming out, when I started in real estate. And I didn't know, I'd uploaded this, my first listing in a place called, out in Center Hill Lake. I had no business listing out that far. I didn't know what I was doing.
Helicopter.
Hey, helicopter, if you can hear it. If not, oh, well, there's a helicopter above us. Because we're next door to the hospital that has the landing pad on it. That's what that's from. So I was looking and saying, hey, you got this listing. It's out in the middle of nowhere. How can you really promote it? It was an expired listing that someone had listed for like 300-400 days, and here I'm taking it over. So I did a video of it and I put it up on YouTube and it sold. Well, I was at a real estate convention called Inman News a few years later, and a guy comes up to me from homes.com and he goes, "You're Brian Copeland, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "You're the first person to ever upload a video to YouTube that's about real estate." I said, "What?" He goes, "Yeah, we did a blog on you." And it's like, it was called like the father of real estate video. I was like, "Really?" And again, you know, back then I hadn't spoken on a stage or any of those kind of things. And it's like, oh, wow. And so those are the kind of things I took from there was get ahead of technology first. Second thing I learned from there was relationship, relationship, relationship. Because technically a song is the house. The songwriter is, you know, part of that building process. And then the artist who's recording it is the buyer. And in my, I did the same thing. When I came out of music industry, that's why I was successful my first year in real estate. I didn't know what I was doing. But after my very first year, I'd sold 62 homes. And in 9 months. And people were like, "What are you doing?"
I'm
like,
crazy, by the way.
It's crazy. By myself. And I said, "I'm just doing the music industry. I'm innovating. I'm treating people with great relationships, and I'm treating these homes like songs, and we're going to sell them like we sell songs."
You've talked a lot about this to me, and it's the concept of early adoption and how important it is to, you know, when things are new, just try them. You know, it may not work, and it's okay if it doesn't work, but what if it does? And you're the one that was there first that was really utilizing this tool or technology or platform in a way that nobody really knew was possible. And obviously that helped you out a lot in the music industry career that you had, and it helped you out a lot in the real estate career that you had too. So bravo. Good job, Dad. Proud of you.
Well, in early adoption, I mean, we two, three episodes ago, we talked about AI. And, you know, and I even struggle with certain adoption. So we all get it. And, you know, we talked about that. So I want to hear your story now. So
For me, music has just always been a part of my life. You know, I can't say that I grew up in a musical house, because while I did, you know, when I spent time with my sperm donor and got to go to his house and play the piano there, singing definitely wasn't something that happened in the home. My mother couldn't carry a tune in a bucket. You know, no one in my family really sang at all. My grandmother, my mother's mom, had a trumpet. It's really, technically it's called a cornet, but it's a kind of trumpet. A cornet, C-O-R-N-E-T. And I still have it. It's at my house today, that she bought in 1945. So it's coming up on being almost a 100-year-old instrument, and I don't even know if it still plays anymore because I don't touch it. But I did play trumpet in middle school band, and then like most trumpet players in middle school, I switched over to the French horn in high school, and marched French horn and mellophone, and played that in the symphonic bands in high school and in college. And when I was getting ready to go to college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I knew, well, the only thing that really I'm good at is music. And so I thought, well, let me just go to school for music. And so I went to a small town college in Arkansas called the University of Arkansas at Monticello. It's not the University of Arkansas, but it's part of the U of A system. Okay. And the town had 3,000 people in it. So itty bitty town. And, you know, to me, that was still a large town because where I grew up was less than 1,000 people. And so I thought, I've really made it. I'm here in the big city now because there's a Walmart here and there's right. all, you know, there's all this stuff here. There's more than
Holiday
one.
Inn.
There's a Holiday Inn. There's more than one traffic light. Yeah. So I thought I had made it, and was really fortunate and blessed to have some amazing educators at that school who really instilled in me a lot of great values that are really part of the core of who I am as a musician today.
And sorry to interrupt, but I remember finding them on YouTube, you playing in college. Because again, you know, we weren't family at that point, and I bawled my eyes out watching you play.
Yeah.
You know, because you were so, you could tell you've come so far from those videos. And you were just a scrawny little skinny booger.
Yeah, I was 100 pounds soaking wet. And, you know, I even at that point, I was probably one of the best players that school had ever had. But I wasn't that great.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're in a town in Southeast Arkansas, there's just the talent pool is pretty limited as it is. And so it felt good to be there and to be the star, quote unquote, of the program. And so, you know, studied jazz piano while I was there. And after I left college, ended up working on cruise ships. We had talked about that in a previous episode. Got the gig because one of the professors at the college knew that I was looking for work in the music industry, and was friends with a guy named Frank Suman, Rob Suman. Suman Entertainment Group is the company that I worked for. I forget what the guy's first name was, but they're based out of Miami, Florida, and they had, you know, a gig booking musicians on almost every cruise line in the world. So you've named it, and I worked on it: Holland America, Royal Caribbean, Princess, Celebrity, Norwegian Cruise Lines, all of these, you know, all these major cruise lines, I've worked on them. And so I got the call for this gig, and he was like, you know, we want to have an audition. So I did the audition and I got the job, and they said, well, you've got the job now. You're on the roster. And that's what you got the job meant. It didn't mean that we have a gig for you. So I was part of the roster. Well, about a week later, I get a call and they say, hey, we've got an opening on a ship and we think you'd be a good fit for it. And I said, okay, great. Where is it? And they said, it's in Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
And so here I was, you know, had never left the state, really. Had spent most of my life in small towns in Arkansas. Maybe had traveled to the Texas side of Texarkana for a football game. Maybe had been down to parts of northern Louisiana for a football game in the college. And ended up getting on a plane and going to Hawaii. And so I spent a 6-month contract was normal. It's a normal contract period for a cruise ship worker. Spent my first 6 months in Hawaii and was just, it was like night and day. It was like my eyes had been opened to this world that existed beyond small town, and a totally different culture, a totally different kind of people. All of the actors and dancers on the shows on the ship were people that were, you know, either from Los Angeles or New York or Miami.
Yeah.
And so they had a totally different view of the world. They were accepting of queer people. And I just felt like $1 million the whole time I was there. Had to learn so much music because, of course, I was 21 at the time and I was playing in piano bars. And these little old ladies who were 90 years old would come up to me and say, you know, hey, young man, my husband and I are celebrating our 50th anniversary. Can you play the song from our wedding?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that wedding happened 30 years before I was even born. So I had to go, and they call it shedding in the music industry.
What?
Shedding. S-H-E-D-D-I-N-G. Yeah.
This is a PG podcast.
They call it shedding, and it's when you go and you learn stuff. You go to the shed and you learn stuff.
Oh, okay.
And so I learned tons and tons of music, and most of it ended up being things from the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And, you know, it wasn't the music that I wanted to learn, but luckily I had enjoyed listening to it from my time working in jazz ensembles in college and growing up. Even I would listen to some Benny Goodmans and some of the older jazz standards. So I did that, played, got to travel the world, ended up getting rebooked and rebooked and rebooked and rebooked. And so would go to ships all over the world and spent a lot of time in the Mediterranean, spent a lot of time in the Baltic, spent a lot of time in South America. Cause you know, of course, all the Caribbean cruises that happen, where you get dropped off in a new Mexico city or Venezuela city or whatever it is every day you're in a new city. Cause these cruises are 4 or 5 days long and you go out, you cruise for 2 days, city, and then you're back home.
Right.
So got to travel a lot, got to see the world. By the time I was 26 or 27, I had been to that many countries, and it just made me feel amazing. And
so how did that transition? How did you get to Nashville?
Well, I met this guy on a ship, and we fell in love and decided that we were going to move in together.
Spoiler, it didn't last.
Spoiler alert, it didn't last. And so he was living in Nashville, and decided to invite me to move in with him. And so I did, moved to Nashville. About 6 months after that, we ended up cutting things off because, you know, I was working in Italy and he was working in Alaska. And you just can't, there's right. long distance and then there's long distance.
Right.
And that was the latter. And so, you know, the relationship just didn't work. We couldn't make it work, and that's fine. It is what it is. We were great friends for a while after that, and we're still acquaintances now, and
yep.
I still check in on him from time to
time.
But yeah. But I ended up moving to Nashville, and, you know, over the next few years, spent time in Nashville, worked in hotels because, you know, I thought, well, I'm a pretty hospitable Southern person. I can work in hotels,
right.
And so did that for a while. And then one day, a friend of mine gave me a call and said, hey, I just got a call from this guy. I think he's from the UK or something. He's from London. He's got a British accent. He wants me to go out with this artist. I can't do it. You know, I'm already booked up. Would you be interested in auditioning? And so I said, yeah, sure, I'll audition. So talked to this guy, Steve, from the UK, and ended up driving out to this artist's farm in Colombia. And auditioned for him for about 2 hours. He, you know, would ask me to play his music. It ended up that he was a Southern gospel artist that I grew up listening to and was obsessed with. Had spent most of my childhood listening to his music, and was his voice was just incredible.
Yeah.
Just an incredibly recognizable persona and the charisma and the energy, and it's just a showstopper. And I got to work for him. Yay. I got the gig. So I spent about 2 years working for him, got to travel the world with him and do amazing music and work with amazing musicians and other singers and instrumentalists and made some great friendships during my time there.
And what is that, all that time, what did that teach you about, you know, discipline, connection, help handling pressure, all that stuff? What did it teach you there?
You know, there were some really high pressure moments when you're on a stage in front of 5,000 people, 5,000 plus people sometimes.
With a symphony.
With a symphony behind you.
That video's great, too. Yeah, that video's great.
Yeah, the video he's talking about, there's a video. I got to go out with this artist to Switzerland. We did a tour, and we were in Switzerland. And I'm on stage, and there's a full 200-piece symphonic orchestra behind me, and then a 400-person choir behind the symphony.
And then a huge audience.
And a huge audience. And we're in this huge arena, and the back wall of the arena behind the orchestra and the choir is a huge glass window, floor to ceiling, like 20 feet tall and probably 100 feet wide. And they had it curtained off while we were doing all of our rehearsals and stuff. Well, then they opened up the curtains the night that we came to perform. And, you know, just casually, there's the Swiss Alps in the background of your concert. And, you know, those were some really high pressure moments. Yep. And I was in charge of a lot of the technology for the show, for mm-hmm. the live music, because we had a lot of songs that required, you know, backing tracks. And I was responsible for making sure that they were set up before the show and that they played during the show at the right time during the show. And there were a few moments where, you know, the technology failed, as it does from time to time. And in that kind of environment and that kind of atmosphere where you've got 5,000 people watching you, you have to make split second decisions and decide, okay, do we stop the show or do we keep going and just play acoustic? Yep. And so that kind of taught me to work under pressure and how to think quickly on my feet, which has helped a lot here in the real estate world.
Yeah.
Because there are times when people ask questions that require you to say, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, but I will find out for you.
Yeah.
And the worst possible thing you can do in that situation is lie and make something up.
Yep.
And you have a split second to decide, am I going to tell the truth and say, hey, I don't know the answer to that. Or, you know, I don't know, let me find out for you. Or are you just going to BS and, you know, come up with some answer and then end up being wrong and potentially lose a client? Yeah. So.
And speaking of telling the truth, I spilled my water and I'm thirsty, so we need to take a break. Because there's water all over the floor. We'll be right back.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
All right, well, I got my water. I'm ready to go back, so break's over, but yay. I can't believe I spilled all that. I feel bad. It's all over the floor.
Security,
get him out of here. So we were talking about music.
Yeah.
You heard my story. I heard your story. So let's talk about Nashville a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, because Nashville, people think country music.
As they should.
As they should.
Yeah.
You know, you think bachelorette parties, cowboy hats, cowboy boots. But Nashville's a lot more, so let's talk a little bit about Nashville music.
Yeah, so Nashville, you've got, obviously, the mother church of country music, the Ryman. You know, you've got the Grand Ole Opry, which is an amazing venue. But there's so many other venues here in town. There's other places to see music. You know, we've got the Exit Inn, which has had Prince has performed there. Earth, Wind, and Fire has performed there. You know, there's been big artists and small artists of all genres that have performed there. The Bluebird Cafe, we've talked about that a lot.
But there's also, beyond venues, there's also a lot of genres here. People, again, think country music.
Yeah.
But here also, you've got a huge pop scene.
Uh-huh.
You've got a huge roots and Americana scene.
Yep.
The Barbershop Quartet is based here. We drive by that all the time. There's the Bluegrass Association is here at the end of this street, not on the street, but if we go to Ellington Parkway and down where I get my beard cut.
Yeah.
They're next door to that.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of things people don't know. Those genres are here.
Yeah.
They put us in that, there's the country music only, but there's when you're here as working here or living here, you're going to meet musicians who do everything.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people also forget that because the quality of musicianship here is so high, you know, just because someone is a great guitar player doesn't necessarily pigeonhole them into only playing country music.
Yeah.
You have some of the best mixers and masters and engineers in the world here in Nashville.
Yeah.
And so music that is hip hop could be mixed or mastered here. Music that is heavy metal or grunge metal or rock could be mastered here, engineered here, produced here. There's so much that happens here.
In engineering, we actually sold the house where Taylor Swift's first album was engineered.
Their first
Grammy Award winning album.
That's true.
We sold that house with a studio.
Yeah.
And it's roughly a tenth of a mile from where we're sitting right
now. That's true.
We could walk to it.
Yeah, we could. We could.
And I remember everybody coming and like, we had to stay in the studio because it had the Grammys in there and everything. Uh-huh. And people were like, you know, and the sellers were like, y'all have to stay here with it.
Yeah.
And we're like, okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, that's the thing is when you're showing houses here, you never know. You walk into these studios. We sold the house of, and I won't say who, but a musician passed away and we sold that estate just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And being in that studio and knowing some of the greats had recorded songs there. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
It is.
You know, I listed a home where, you know, they said Johnny Cash sat out on the the upper deck and wrote a certain song there.
Yeah.
And hearing those stories, I mean, that's what I love about Nashville and all these scenes that are here. And, you know, you mentioned so many great places like the Ryman, and we saw, you know, concerts at the Ascend. You know, what's your favorite venues you've seen some shows in here?
Obviously the Skremerhorn, the Symphony Center. Okay.
Always forget that one.
Every I know. Yeah. That one. The acoustics in there are just incredible. One of my least favorite and most favorite things about that venue, it's kind of the same side of a coin, is no cell service in there at all. You know, you are lucky to get one bar. And that's great, because while you're there, you shouldn't be on your phone. You're there to enjoy some people who are truly masters of their craft, pouring their hearts out on the stage. One of my favorite shows that I've seen there was 2 or 3 years ago. Micah and I went to go see the Black Panther in concert. Mm-hmm. We got to watch the Black Panther movie, and one of the original recording artists who played some of the African drums that was in the movie ended up being there and playing the drums live for us while we were there. Mm-hmm. And so to see that show live with that musician live was just amazing. It was amazing. What about you? Which one of your favorite venues in town?
One of my favorite venues closed, and believe it or not, it was a restaurant, Sambuca in the
Gulch. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They had great jazz.
I remember going to the bathroom in there and going, oh, listen to this Muzak. It sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm. Muzak.
Right. And then I walked out. It wasn't Muzak. Mm-hmm. It was the live from the stage.
Yep.
That's how great it sounded.
Yeah.
So I love going to Sambuca, and just for that, because when you go to the restaurants here and you go to these events, mm-hmm. the sound quality is so good.
Yeah.
And you know, you've been, as a real estate person, I've been out as a speaker for years too. Mm-hmm. And I remember going into these hotels and convention spaces and working with their audio crews and be like, oh, I'm so spoiled to Nashville.
Yeah.
Because when you're in Nashville, you know, these people that are doing their part-time jobs, they're out on the road during the week with major artists.
Yeah.
So, you know, going to Sambuca and hearing that audio quality was just amazing.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of the concerts that are like in Nissan Stadium. They kind of turn into sing-alongs, mm-hmm. and I just don't, that's not my concert experience. Yeah,
I'm the same way. I'm there to hear the artist, not you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a big fan of the sing-alongs, but,
yeah.
You know, speaking of audio, I want to give our listeners a tip. If you go to a concert, or if you go see a show or theater, anything like that,
one
of the best places to sit is as close as you can sit to where the sound engineers are, especially if they're out in the house. Typically, they're in the middle, and they're about midway back. People think the front row seats are the best. Visually, that may be true. But acoustically, if you want the best acoustic experience when you go to a show, sit as close as you possibly can to the sound engineers and the sound guys.
And we talked about this in our first episode of Getting to Know Us. We, you know, we saw Toto, and we moved to seats right in front of that. And then we go see Jacob Collier at one of my favorite venues at Ascend Amphitheater. Uh-huh. And when we were picking our tickets, you're like, I want to be here, Dad. You know. Yeah. And so Ascend Amphitheater, as far as outdoor concert venues, is my favorite place. But again, you can get great music. Like when Sweet Cece's Yogurt was open, and there were concerts there, like, and you'd be amazed. Go to our airport. Remember, we were flying out to somewhere, and that girl was singing, and we had to go talk to her.
Incredible.
Like, oh my gosh, this is in Nashville. Yeah. So, you know, in other cities, you think about music venues being, you know, the auditoriums or
arenas or
not necessarily here.
Yeah.
Some of your best music doesn't happen at the biggest venue. So, you know, we talked about the bigger ones, but there's a lot of small ones too that are just great.
You know, we had also mentioned, I think last week or the week before, we talked about the Nashville Accordion Society.
Yeah.
At the Bavarian Beer House at Opry Mills, of all places, they have live music. Mm. And sometimes it's polka, sometimes it's, you know, more jazzy stuff, but it's always great music. And that's, you know, almost any restaurant that you go into town, you can find good music. Even further outside of town, like in Murfreesboro, Micah does shows at a place called Tipsy Thai.
Yep.
And it's this great Thai restaurant, and he and his band, the Pink Chihuahua, are there.
Oh, he's going to love you for that.
Yeah. He and his band, the Pink Chihuahua,
every
are there.
Month, yeah.
You got to go see them when they play. They're great. They're young musicians, but they are awesome. They are awesome.
They are.
So, yeah.
And it's everywhere like that. So, you know, we were talking earlier about some of the stuff that's come into our real estate life with it. And we were talking about listing studios. And have you seen anything interesting when you've been out showing that was music oriented?
You know, it's, you can flip a coin, and it's heads or tails whether when you walk into a listing if there'll be a platinum record on the wall, or if there'll be Grammys on the desk somewhere. You know, obviously one of my favorite things when we go into a listing is if they have a piano, a grand piano. I always sit down and play it every single time.
We're closing the house soon, and you actually play the piano. They weren't there, and I took video of you playing the piano and sent it to the sellers, and they were like, "Oh, we love this piano, hasn't been played." and they told me it was really out of tune. You're like, "It's not that bad," so it made them feel really good as they moved to their new house. And it's funny because when you're showing houses, we've got one we're listing this week that the guy has played for the symphony, and spaces for pianos when you're looking for houses here.
Yeah.
I mean, the weirdest things when you're showing houses here, and these are things that people in other cities don't understand. There's certain lighting things you got to be concerned about where the sunlight comes in. It's got to be in a certain room you can't get upstairs.
Yeah.
And some people don't want to have keyboards, they have grand pianos.
Yeah.
And in Nashville, you'll see a lot of converted dining rooms. Uh-huh. It's funny when you're looking at our listing descriptions. We actually search for, you know, there's a thing called percent search in our MLS. We'll search for percent piano, percent studio. Uh-huh. And studio here doesn't mean like a studio, you know, open like a hotel. We're talking about a music studio. So we've had to be really careful about making sure we name things right.
Right.
Because music amenities and real estate here are normal.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are concerned about, can they do commercial stuff in neighborhoods?
Yeah.
Because, you know, most cities, commercial business is not allowed in residential neighborhoods.
Right.
But here, you could be next door in Brentwood to a huge mansion, and downstairs is a
state-of-the-art recording studio. It's a
$500,000 studio in that basement.
Yeah.
And there's artists coming in and out of there. So it's very different seeing here in Nashville. And we were talking about the history of like these other places, but there's things that are still happening here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and if you're wanting to move to Nashville and you're interested in that, you can actually find turnkey studios here for sale.
Yeah, you can. They're absolutely here. We know where some are. We have obviously friends and colleagues in the real estate industry who know where some are as well. I want to switch gears really quickly, and I want us to talk about crossover lessons, ways that music industry have directly affected the way that we work in real estate. So really quickly, I'm just going to give you some rapid fire questions, and I want you to tell me what you think.
I'm not ready for
about
these.
Yeah, I want you to tell me. Want you to tell me what you think.
I'll get you back in a few
That's
minutes.
That's totally fine. Okay. That's totally fine. What are the similarities between reading an audience and reading a client?
Similarities between reading an audience and reading the client. Gosh, you got to sit back and listen and do your homework before you go in. Just with any audience, if you're going to sit down, you were talking about cruise ships. You had newer songs in your repertoire, but you had to learn the old ones. Mm-hmm. When we're going in with a client, I've got to know who they are. Mm-hmm. I've got to know, for example, this came up. Not every home sale is a celebration.
Yeah.
And we think home sales are celebrations, but some of them come with pain.
That's a great point.
And I had one tell me recently, I don't want to sell my home.
Yeah.
However, I thought this was going to be my life home with my husband and kids, but that ended. And so I don't want to celebrate. So when I was calling to say, we've got it under contract, they've agreed, I didn't say congratulations. Mm-hmm. It was more like factual.
Yeah.
I was showing recently someone who had it's so hard to say, they lost their child at birth.
Yeah.
And you walk and show homes and there's a nursery in there. Mm-hmm. And the sensitivities that have to go with that.
Yeah.
If you don't know enough about your client, just like you with your audience on the cruise ship, mm-hmm. and you're walking into a baby nursery and saying, oh, y'all have kids. And again, not every consumer is going to open and tell you those things, but you need to be sensitive about it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to walk into a nursery ever with a client I'm showing and say, oh, are y'all thinking about having kids? Because I don't know their story.
Exactly.
And so even if you don't know, just like your audience, you may not know their story. Mm-hmm. But how do you continue to show homes and be sensitive to those needs? And so understanding not everything's a celebration, not every room will be used the same way. So I guess that's my best answer to that.
Yeah, you know, my answer to that would be it's about reading energy and matching energy or creating energy. Yeah. You know, one of the most important things about when you're working with an audience is understanding what their energy levels are. Oh, yeah. And we're laughing because, you know, we're both at, we're both also at church, and I'm the worship pastor at our church. And so you know, I have to go in and say, what is the energy level of the congregation this morning? Or when I was playing in cruise ships, what is the energy level of the people in this bar right now? Right. Are they drunker than Cooter Brown, or are they just getting started?
Yeah.
You know, and that determines what you can do as an artist or as a leader. The same was with a client. You know, when you are interacting with a client, if you go to meet somebody for showings and they are, tell me the facts, what are the numbers? That analytical side of things, you have to turn off your artist brain and turn on your science brain.
Yep.
And give them numbers and data. Or maybe they come in and they're just happy-go-lucky and they're giddy and they're talking about, oh, these paint colors are so beautiful and I love the cabinets that they've done in here. And what kind of wood is this? Do you know what kind of wood this is on the floor? Or, you know, what kind of tree is that outside? You have to turn off the analytical and the science and move more into the art. And so reading a room, whether there are 1,000 people in the room or whether there's one person in the room, it's a fine art skill that you have to be able to do that. So let's talk about performance skills versus presentation skills.
Okay.
So when you're performing, there are certain things that you do that can shift the room, that can change the energy in the room. When you are presenting, whether you're presenting as a speaker at an event for real estate or whether you're presenting at a listing presentation to a client, there are certain things that you can say or do that will shift the energy in the room. Can you talk to me a little bit about that and ways that you've seen that?
Well, I think every time when you go into a listing appointment, people are nervous.
Yeah.
We're nervous because, you know, we're meeting with someone for the first time and we're kind of applying for a job.
Sure.
But we do this all the time. So for me, I know the path I'm going down, but there's a nervousness with a seller because they haven't done this before. And perhaps they've Googled the worst questions in the world to ask. Yeah. And y'all, if you're listening as a consumer, we know these questions and we get them all the time. But one of the things I always do is shift on because to calm that nerve is I open with the same question with every seller I sit down with. What pain do you have in this process?
Yeah.
Because when we can get to the pain of what someone is experiencing or what they're fearful of, then they can listen to everything else. But when they have worries and we're in there talking about, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to market it this way, listen to our podcast, they're not concerned about that. They're more concerned about, am I going to be able to get my children through their school year before we move? Am I going to be able to find the next home? Oh, and the economy's not great, and we may go into four. Those are the things you got to know that pain point on.
Yeah.
So that would be I guess, how I see shifts happening. And it starts with that question. And sometimes it's not emotional. Sometimes it's just like, I'm afraid I don't know what to do with this paint color. Okay, that's simple. But that's, I guess, how I've learned how to shift. How about you?
You know, for me, I guess there are things that you can say. There are body language is a very, very powerful tool that I think a lot of people forget about, especially on stage, but also in one-on-one conversations and really intrapersonal relationships that you have with people. When you're sitting across from a buyer, from a seller, and it's just you and them one-on-one, you know, your body language can, you know, either create some tension, it can create some anxiety, or it can do the opposite and it can ease their mind and it can make them calm. Same on a stage. You know, if you're on a stage and you've got your hands in your pockets and you're nervous and you look like you don't know what you're talking about and you're very timid and shy and your body language is closed off, the room is going to eat you alive. Mm-hmm. Versus if you go in there and you have these powerful poses and stances and you look like someone who knows what they're doing, they already have that believability in you and you've already got that down. So that's what I would say would be the answer to that question. So we're going to move over to the game show portion today.
Because you're not going to like me for this one.
Oh, no. So we're playing Nashville Rathers.
Nashville Rathers time.
Nashville Rathers.
And I texted it. I didn't put it on our guidelines today because I didn't want you to see it. And it's really long and verbose.
Okay.
And you're going to be like, Poppy, I don't want to do that. And I love my impersonation of you because you never talk like that.
I never, ever talk like that.
But it just makes me think about your complaining adult voice.
Uh-huh.
So you're going to complain about this one. You're going to say, never do something like this again because it's really verbose. You can't leave either of these concerts until they are done, and you can't wear noise-canceling devices or take your phone. So that is the first premise.
Okay.
You can't leave, you can't wear noise-canceling headphones, and you cannot take your phone with you. Would you rather go to the Nashville Yards, the Pinnacle, and attend 8 hours straight, an 8-hour straight showcase of beginning songwriters who are tone deaf from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. or a two-hour show at Santa's Pub where they are allowed to smoke with show choir performances from 10 p.m. till midnight.
Oh, my
gosh. So 8 hours or 2 hours, which one are you going to choose?
You know, wow.
Because you hate both of them.
This is so
cruel.
How dare you, first of all. Let's see. Okay, so
Pinnacle, great venue.
Mm-hmm. It is a great venue.
No smoking.
But they're beginner songwriters and they're tone deaf.
For 8 hours.
8 hours of it.
But during the day.
But I don't have my phone with me. Nope. So I would rather do the Pinnacle, to be honest. Okay. You know, I think I could take probably a lot of NyQuil before and lull myself into a deep sleep because
I left that off the rules.
Yeah, I just found the loophole. So I could lull myself into a deep sleep with some NyQuil because they're singer songwriters and so they're probably playing acoustic instruments and it's more bearable. I can't do a smoking venue. Being around smoke, my allergies are already bad enough as it is. I already have a lot of sensory overwhelmedness that happens to me pretty easily. So I think the smell of smoke, the sound of show choirs.
Shoot, I was hoping you wouldn't say it because you hurt my feelings. Like about 2 years ago, I asked him to go to a show choir show with me. There was a show choir competitions here every year in Nashville over at Opryland Hotel. And I was like, let's go. And you were like, I hate show choirs and I love them. It's kind of like your love for bands.
Yeah,
I love show choirs and you told me no.
Mind you, he's just now telling me 2 years later that I hurt his feelings 2 years ago by telling him this.
Yeah.
So my answer is I'll take the Pinnacle. It's a new venue. It's cool. There's room. They probably have comfortable seats. Versus Santa's Pub. I've been to Santa's Pub once. We'll never go again. It's just not the place for me. Not the place for me at all.
That was a tough one.
It was tough.
Tone deaf. You don't like smoke. You don't like show choirs. You don't like. But, you know, that's part of Nashville Rathers, and they can't be easy. So
they can't be easy.
And you get the next one on the next episode.
So I do, yeah. Pay me back. Oh, I have one. And I have one that I think is going to really trick you up.
Yay.
So, yeah. So that's our Nashville Rathers segment for the day.
And our Nashville, you know, what about Nashville and music?
Yeah.
It's time to kind of move on. So, while music shaped who we are, you know, and even though we've been real estate now, these roots are, you know, what shaped us to who we are today. Yeah.
It's true. We're thankful for all the experiences that we've had that have brought us to this point. Even the tough ones, even working with mean artists, even working with mean record label producers. And some of the great times that we've had being on stages across the world, getting to help people get their start in Music City as musicians. Mm-hmm. It's all kind of shaped who we are and what we do. We're thankful for it all. So,
and we get to orchestrate great moves for people now.
We do.
Yeah. So we want to hear your stories. So share your music story. If you have a music story to share, tell us about your favorite concert, venue, whatever. Follow us on Instagram at NAB Nashville. Like, rate the podcast 5 stars. And
5 out of 5.
Great being with you again.
Would listen again.
And we'll make music with you in the future.
That's right. We'll see y'all next time.
Bye.
This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It does not constitute legal, financial, or real estate advice. Listeners should always consult licensed professionals for guidance specific to their situation. Brian and Zach Copeland are licensed real estate agents with Compass 615-522-5100. Kevin Kennerson, MLS number 171733 with Lindingham Mortgage is the executive producer. Engineer Mike Reeves. Music Dusty Boots by E-Codex. Nashville and Beyond. Copyright 2025.